I'll be discussing our knowledge, current knowledge of the Arctiad phylogeny, and placing what we know about primarily larval life histories in an evolutionary context. This work is not possible without a network, sort of like the Verizon wireless network. I have my network, and all these people significantly contributed to what I'm about to tell you. And I would also like to give photo credits right up front to Bill Connor and Dan Jansen, without whom this would be a terribly under-illustrated talk. So thank you very much for your gorgeous photos. The Arctiad is I won't call it mega-diverse, I've been humbled by the Galechioids, but a reasonably beautifully diverse family. If you collect in the Neotropics, they represent up to 11% of the species you could expect to see at the sheet at night. And certainly their eye-popping adults catch our attention. Their caterpillars, likewise, are very beautiful. And all these beautiful colors, of course, are signaling to us the fact that many of them are chemically protected. The pyrrolizidine alkaloid story has been worked out quite well for Udothysa ornatrix, and I won't belabor it here, but just the caterpillars do obtain toxins, the pyrrolizidine alkaloids, while feeding on their hosts, and transfer these compounds to the adult stage. It has been shown by many studies that pyrrolizidine alkaloids are effective against a number of predators, vertebrates and invertebrates. Matter of fact, one of the favorite ways to test whether or not a moth, an Arctiad, is chemically protected is to, let's see if I can do this without popping to the next slide, is to throw the moth into the web of the common garden spider, and if it is protected, the spider will cut it out of the web, hold it off to the side, and drop it. So, phew. But if it's a yummy moth, it'll just go ahead and suck its blood. So, pyrrolizidine alkaloids can also be effective against parasitoids, and perhaps the most interesting story to recently be discovered and tested is how the Gramia incorrupta larvae self-medicate. So just like if you run a fever and you run and grab a Tylenol or whatever to bring your fever down, these guys feed on a wide variety of plants, and if they are parasitized, they preferentially eat PA-containing plants, which improves their survival rate. And the complicated tritrophic interactions will be much more elegantly described by Mike Singer this afternoon in the Liz Bernays Symposium, which is just around the corner from here. So if you'd like to learn more about self-medicating caterpillars, I highly recommend you go hear Mike's talk. And of course, there's been a ton of work done on how pyrrolizidine alkaloids show up in the courtship of the adults. Males will court females in ornatrix. If he has pyrrolizidine alkaloids, he'll hang around. She will allow him to mate. If he's a underperforming PA male, well, too bad, so sad. She'll find another mate. So, but not all Arctiads are tied to pyrrolizidine alkaloids. And as a matter of fact, many larvae are capable of producing their own suite of chemistries without obtaining them from host plants. These can be very irritating compounds that cause swelling or are generally distasteful. These can act in combination with other chemicals, so there's a synergistic effect if they do sequester plant compounds. And there's even one that's named for Arctiacacia by Miriam Rothschild, which is transported in the hemolymph of the larva. Now, and I should also mention that there are a number of compounds in addition to pyrrolizidine alkaloids that show up in Arctiidae. There's a whole lineage that feeds on lichens, and sequestration of lichen compounds has been demonstrated. cardiac glycosides. There's switches to milkweeds and other plants that have CGs. And most recently, Dean Bowers has been documenting the use of iridoid glycosides in spilosoma and relatives. So I would say that when it comes to larval chemical defenses, there's quite a bit that we know, and we're still discovering more, which is an exciting place to be. Oh, and so one question we could ask is, how is there any pattern to how these chemistries are being used in the Arcteidae? Are they labile evolutionarily, or are they conserved within large lineages? What exactly is happening in Arcteids? And so, obviously, we need a phylogenetic tree. And what I will be doing now is introducing to you one of these. I never started the timer, Amanda. So we'll have to check the watch.
I'm good. I got it.
You got it. Good. All done. I'm not nervous. So Jacobson and Weller embarked. This was a side project of a postdoc. So this tells you. This first explains why it took so long to complete it, because it was a side project. But Nancy and I finally published this work in 2002. We had 31 character systems from the immatures, including that very difficult ketotaxy, larval heads, and pupae, and we had several character systems in the adults. We excluded most genitalic characters for this study because homologies were difficult to determine. And some of you have already seen this tree, but again, just to remind us, because I will be using this as the backbone for the rest of the talk, perhaps one of the most comforting results was that Arcteidae was monophyletic. It's always nice when your study group turns out to be a clade. And the what had been called even its own family at one point, the Tanucidae, which tended to be wasp mimicking adults, broke into two unrelated clades, the Old World Syntomines and then the New World Tanuchines and Euchromienes. And as you see from my little statement, Tanuchine is not monophyletic, nor is much else. And there's a lot of paraphyly in this tree. But it is something. So what we'll do now is step through what we know about the larval histories and chemistries. In the Lithosianae, this is a nice radiation. This is probably an under, we have over 3,000 described species, many undescribed, and I do not have an estimate of undescribed. Not many active workers in this group. Manet and Bendib defined six tribes based on adult morphology, and the very long CD that you see there in the caterpillar is characteristic of the subfamily. Also, caterpillars have this thing called a mola, this enlarged flattened surface that is thought to be used to break up the lichens so that they can eat them. Again, these are lichen or fungivorous feeding moths, and they have specialized mandibles to deal with that host plant. Syntomine, unfortunately, I do not have decent photos of, but it's a relatively small lineage, only a couple hundred described species distributed in two tribes. Again, it's sort of an African, Asian, European distributed lineage. A very interesting mix of records. It includes everything from dead leaves, fungi, and lichens, and mosses to sort of general plants. And these records are archived at the British Museum on T.R. Bell's unpublished manuscripts. So it seems that we have at the base of the Arcteidae a preponderance of lichenivory and fungivory. We'll actually come back to this life history much higher up in the tree much later in this talk. But for now, let's go to the big subfamily Arcteinae, where the majority of the diversity of the Arcteidae lies. And we have a diversity of hosts and a diversity of larval morphologies. In 1988, Holloway declared that no satisfactory classification exists, and so he didn't use anything below the subfamily designation. We follow Kitching and Rollins for now, and as you will see, there's probably some adjustments that will need to be made in the future as our phylogenies become more robust. But this slide gives you sort of the range of phenotypes that you can find in the Arcticini, that basal paraphyletic grade of genera, from very spiky, sort of short seedy to longer hair-like seedy, and then a more sparse distribution of seedy, but still on Faruqi in something like Hypercombi. I'm sorry, that's actually, talk about it later. What we do see in the ancestor of Arcticini and distributed throughout Arcticini is pyrrolizidine alkaloid associations in the larvae, and then higher up a complicated switching pattern that occurs with cardiac glycosides, and we start to get this iridoid glycoside defense. And I just want to note that the IG surveys have just begun, and we're actually under, we really don't know how many Arcticids are potentially utilizing these compounds. That's work by Dean Bowers, by the way. No tribe synapomorphies were identified by Jacobson and Weller. Chris Schmidt recently obtained his PhD at the University of Edmonton, and in that thesis there is a CO1 study that suggests that Ferguson's five groups are in much need of revision. And one thing we can say about the Arcticini is that polyphagy is common, and amongst the host plants that you see, there are plants that contain either pyrrolizidine alkaloids or iridoid glycosides. Particularly the Spilosoma group has a lot of IG plants that they can graze on, that they include in their diets. We see, actually, in throughout Arcticidae, the evolution of heteroideous crochets. You'll see this in the literature. It's referring to the fact that there are shorter lateral seedy with longer crochets in the middle, or crochets, or however we want to pronounce it. We do see a reversal to the more generalized noctuoid condition of homoideous crochets in the Lithosiines and in Verbia. And typically for the Arcticini, we have a robust cocoon. Moving up the tree to the Calamorphini, this is a really relatively small tribe of closely related genera, about 100 species distributed in worldwide. And this is where the evolution of pyrrolizidine alkaloid use with transfer to the adult stage is first really noticeable. And the way I like to think about this is that we're going from PA opportunists, so they include it in the larval diet as polyphagy, but then don't actually really tie their life histories to it. They become dependent on PAs or other chemistries later on in the evolution of the Arcticidae. Also, the transferring something like a pyrrolizidine alkaloid to the adult stage requires some enzymatic machinery so that you don't have the problem of autotoxicity when you metamorphose. So going from a caterpillar to an adult, of course, some tissues are broken down and others reformed, and if you don't do a good job of packaging those toxins or eliminating them in your frass before you metamorphose, you could kill yourself. And clearly this problem of autotoxicity has been solved by the higher Arcticids. Now, this tree you're looking at was generated by Michelle DaCosta and myself based on adult morphologies. There are 91 species, and it was based on, as I said, adult morphologies, over 100 characters. And you've seen that the calamorphine caterpillars tend to be simple-seeded, so we see a reduction in that verrucal mass of seedy. So that seems to be another hallmark of the Calamorphini, slight cocoons, not very hairy caterpillars for being an Arctiid, and definitely PA dependence. Oh, and now we're going to move to the Pericopini plus Nyctimera, which came out with the pericopines in our analyses. And you'll see that in the pericopines we have the first switch to cardiac glycosides, but just a warning, larval consumption does not equate with sequestration. It has actually been shown in Composia fetal... Oh, whoops. Ah, dear. Okay. Page back, please. Yeah. In Composia, which is that very beautiful moth, middle row, far right, I'm not going to use the pointer. The larvae feed on CG plants but do not sequester. Okay, you can see that there is a diversity of larval types in Pericopini. It's less easy to describe the larval type compared to the calamorphines, which is much more canonized. Also, we obviously have some taxonomic work to do because we have wildly different larval morphologies occurring in the same genus, and actually Watson and Goodger suggested that Dyschema really is an artificial genus. And, I haven't mentioned earlier, but social behavior crops up again and again throughout Arctiidae, and here's just a nice picture of some very hungry caterpillars chowing down. Okay, let's move up to the phygopterines. And these include some of our favorite groups, the milkweed tussocks, for one, we've worked on. And you'll notice I have the tribe in quotes. And I have it in quotes because I'm going to show you in a moment that it is wildly polyphyletic. However, based on molecular data, Forbes had recognized roughly four generic groups. We have larval representatives of the first three. I don't know of any representatives of the little transitional group Polemniini, and John Rollins thinks they may be pericopines anyway. But we'll start with Eucades, because we actually know a little bit of... Oh, no, we will start with the evolution of the Phygopterini. I need to show you that they are indeed polyphyletic. This is based on five nuclear loci. We find the Eupseudosoma group up here with some elements of the Halicidota group. Eucades comes out monophyletic, and the rest of the Halicidota group come out monophyletic. And I'll come back to the problem of the tanuquines and euchromienes a little later. Okay, so what I'm going to do is focus in on each of those phygopterine clades. Milkweed tussocks, there is a core set of genera. Unfortunately, Ophrys procoroides is the type of Ophrys, but no other Ophrys goes in that genus that we know of. So that very large genus has got to be revised, and we also don't know what it feeds on. But as far as we know within the rest of the group, cardiac glycosides is widespread, the use, or at least the larval host, and it has consequences for the adult mating systems, which I won't go into now, but if you're interested, it's in the DaCosta paper. So here we see a switch from PA dependence, which is in the outgroups, to a CG dependence. Examples of the Eupseudosoma group, an amazing array of caterpillar types, and host plants, and because we have no phylogeny of the group, I can't begin to trace the evolution of the morphologies or the host use. That's needs to be done. Group. Similarly, the Halicidota group, which is characterized by wing venation, and the larvae tend to have these pencils in the tufting in the front and the back, and you can see those characteristic tufts here again. A very interesting host plants occur in this group. There are probably a lot of switches from PAs to CGs and other compounds, but again, the phylogeny is just a figment of my imagination, and I won't bore you with it right now. Some interesting life histories and morphologies that I want to focus on actually are in Malacea and Bertholdia. And Bertholdia is where we find a return to lichenivory. Now, Dan Jansen at this point is probably sitting up and going, what? You might recall that in the old literature, Bertholdia is said to feed on citrus leaves. Well, it turns out they don't feed on citrus leaves as first, second, or third instar larvae. They feed on the epiphytic growth on citrus leaves. And then, about third instar, they drop off, they stop feeding on epiphytic growth and become polyphagous. So if you look at the rearing records on the ACG website, you'll see that they're reared from a variety of host plants. And so what we see is a return to polyphagy and a return to epiphytic feeding. A very fascinating life history that's been documented by John Rollins and Nancy Jacobson and myself, and I don't know how widespread this behavior is when you get up here in the Halicidota group, but something to watch out for if you're trying to raise caterpillars in the field. Okay, so moving along, the evolution of life histories. We're just going to take a peek at what we know about tanuchines and eucromines. We have a preliminary phylogeny for the tanuchines and eucromines. Please visit Sarah Johnson's poster tomorrow to learn more about it. And I just want to show you that we have a lot of phylogenetic work to do. Here's Eucerion in a couple of places. These are larvae of Eucerion. These are larvae, the top one of Eucerion. Obviously, a diversity of larval types, not related to each other. We've got a lot of work to do. Very cute eucromines. Gosh, aren't they drop-dead gorgeous? Okay, so a summary of trends and directions. Based on what we know, which obviously we've got a lot of phylogenetic work left to do, we can definitely say there is a fungal lichen relationship in the Syntomine Lithosiine lineages, and that this reappears in Bertholdia and maybe other Arctiini in the broad sense. PAU evolves in the ancestor of Arctiini, and PA opportunism or self-medication appears to be the hallmark of Arctiini, with potentially reversal to that again in the higher phygopterines, whatever that group is. Host chemistry specialization evolves multiple times, and we will need better phylogenies to actually trace down how many times these specializations occur and in what directions. The other results you see up on the slide are fairly self-evident. If you'd like to learn more about tiger moths, and this will be my close, Bill Connor has an edited book that will be coming out next year. Dave Wagner has an excellent chapter on Arctiid larvae in that. Ring Cardet has a nice chapter on pheromones, and a whole bunch. Anything you ever wanted to know about Arctiids will be in this book. Promise. With that, I thank my funding sources, leptree.net, and all my collaborators. Thank you.
Thank you. One question, and then we're going to have a break, and we'll be back here at 10:05.
Yes, Mike? Yeah, so Mike's comment, in case you couldn't hear it in the back, is that the machinery, the neurophysiological and I forgot the other big word you just used, it's all there to both recognize PAs, eat them, sequester them, and pass them on to the adult stage, but that whole developmental program is not expressed, and it's later on in Arctiids that you see the canonization into a certain direction. It's a very striking fact. And you've got a chapter in Bill's book, right? Yeah. Sorry, I left out. another question, Dan?
How comfortable are you with this idea of subsuming our deity inside of Noctuity?
Oh, I thought someone might ask that. How comfortable am I with calling Arctiids Noctuids? In the phylogeny chapter in Bill's book, I point out that what we really have here are competing taxonomies and incomplete analyses. And so before I agree with major taxonomic changes, I would like to have the data analyzed. And right now we have the morphology trees that have been proposed by Fibinger and LaFontaine, and then the second paper by LaFontaine and Fibinger. They've not been subjected to a rigorous cladistic analysis. It's Hennigian argumentation, and actually the trees are different between the two papers if you look at the papers closely. And I'm not saying they're wrong, I'm just saying they're hypotheses that are evolving, and if I would be happy to call Arcteids Arebids, because they seem to go there with molecular data. But again, the sampling by Mitchell et al., which suggests that, that study was not designed to answer that question. And so I feel we really don't know. And I would prefer to leave Noctuidae as Mitchell et al. Had circumscribed it. And we don't know where some of the former Noctuid subfamilies go. I'm okay with that. We have these enigmatic micro-Noctuids that just showed up on the radar screen. And so I'm still calling it Arcteidae, even though Mike Fibinger says, you know, you're like a female Atlas holding Arcteidae up on your back and just being stubborn. I'm like, okay, so I'm persistent. But no, I think it's as I concluded in that chapter, I think it's really an exciting time in Noctuid systematics. We're really not settled.